you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. Another bonus feature in the Ben Jarofsky Show. I guess this would be Monday. So it's Monday. Hey, happy Monday, everybody. I'm probably still sleeping as you hear this. My guest is Tim Tutton. Well, people say, Tim Tutton. He's the dude that owns the Hideout. Yeah, but now he owns the Hideout. He is a public school teacher. And before that, he was an aide to Arne Duncan. So he has been in Washington. He knows a thing or two about local politics because as the head of the Hideout, he was sort of one of the leaders of the fight against Lincoln Yards, resistance. He's a school teacher, so he knows a thing or two about Chicago public schools. He's runs the Hideout along with his wife, Katie. I know Katie's the brains of the operation. So
that's right.
Just giving a shout out to Katie.
Hey.
It's a small businessman and playing the game in Washington. He knows how things go in Washington. So a lot to cover with you, young man. You ready to do it?
I'll try.
All right.
Early Monday morning.
Yeah, it's early Monday morning. Oh, wow. Ooh, man, I'm still hungover.
It's been a busy weekend at the Hideout, you know?
All right, so Hideout, 1354 West Wabansia. It's still there. It hasn't been eradicated yet. It's a great little bar in an area that used to be heavily manufacturing when young Tim and Katie moved there in the 1995. Do I have that correct?
1996 is when we owned it.
All right,
when
you bought it in 1996. Mm-hmm. Nobody could probably predict that the day would come in 2019 where the city of Chicago would be dedicating over $1 billion, that's with a B, dollars to hand out to a developer to build a huge complex in the area, paving over and knocking out all the industry and the manufacturing that existed there forever and ever and building a mega loop, mini loop on the north side. I certainly couldn't have predicted that. And so here we are, but you've led the resistance. Talk about that, the resistance to Lincoln Yards.
I don't know where to start. I didn't lead the resistance. You could argue Katie was the one who started Chicago Independent Venue League. And so we... I don't even know where to start.
All right.
But yes, we are in ground zero. The concrete's been broken across the street in the parking lot, and they're starting to dig holes for the 65-story tower that they're going to build. That, you know, was a compromise. Originally, they requested an 85-story tower, but they heard that the neighbors wanted it to be more pedestrian-friendly and more neighborhoody, so they lowered that to 65.
All right, anyway, so how will the Hideout exist? Now, the Hideout, folks, if you haven't been there, I'll try to describe it. It's a house. It's a house on a street, and it used to be across, there was where the garbage trucks were kept. That was the Fleet facility. They moved that to the south side. Now they're putting these skyscrapers, these high-rises here. How will the Hideout exist during all this construction, the start of the construction, then of course when the skyscrapers are operating, but with the construction, how are you guys going to be able to stay in business?
So we are the we are what made America great. We are a small house that was converted into a small business on a side street that has working people who go to it. We are a Main Street small business, hardworking, middle America kind of place. And that means nothing can blow us over. So we're going to be there. We've been there since the 1860s, which Tim Samuelson, the city historian, confirmed.
The building itself has been there since the 1860s.
The building was
not
built.
You.
No,
okay.
not us. But last night we did a celebration of Walt Whitman's birthday at the Hideout, and we realized that the Hideout was there when Walt Whitman was a poet in 1860s.
Was alive.
The building was built as a house. In the 1860s, it was converted into a boarding house, a rooming house in the 1880s. And then around 1910, 1912, before World War I, it started to become a public house. And by 1917, it was an active public house. We predated the Prohibition. and we were an unlicensed
You survived bar. The prohibition.
And to us, the hideout, we were already running an underground business by 1910. Uh-huh. And so, you know, it was the old days when I guess if you were able to find the right alderman, you were able to stay in business.
I don't know how old those days are.
When I was seeing Burke yesterday on the City Hall, I'm like, God darn, it looks like those days are coming to an end.
Yeah.
All right, but it's been a great two centuries of that. luckily, we got in while that was still the way things were done in this city. So back before the days of Patty Baller and Hinky Dink Kenna and those kind of guys, we were one of those places, public houses, that went into business. So by 1917, we were already operating as a public house. By 1919, when the prohibition came into effect, it didn't affect us in one way or another. We just kept running as we did until reform came to Chicago around 1934. And then...
Reform in quotes, by the way.
Yeah, we had to get a license.
But prohibition was over by then, so you could have... That's probably why you had to get a license, because suddenly, you know, it was legal again.
It was, yes, and it was 1930, like, whatever the prohibition ended, but it was 34 when the first big round of bars were licensed in the city, the Berghoff and the Green Door and all those places. So the hideout was part of that 1934.
And so it's a legal way to shake people down. Think about this, Tim. So now the bar owners had to go to the city for a license to get that approval. They probably had to pay a little something. Whereas in the old days, they just had to pay a little something so they could operate illegally, if you follow what I just said.
Right.
So
right.
It was a more legal way of shaking people down.
It was. The fact is, like Tim Samuelson talks about this, the fact was the hideout, when before there was licensing, after the prohibition ended and the city set up a licensing system, there was 1,000 hideouts. Every other house was a public house. Mm. Every other house was having a party that just, you could buy liquor anywhere. And so kind of like the way things are done now in marijuana, right? Who sells marijuana? The kid on the corner. And so it was all over the place. And so the prohibition helped the city shut down all of these houses. So people always picture this Al Capone era where there were these big fancy nightclubs or the Green Mill, a place like that. Mm-hmm. But the reality was everybody's mom and his grandma was selling their own homemade whiskey.
All right. So, but going back to the question I asked, so can you assure the hideout lovers, people who've been going to the hideout forever, that you'll be able to keep the doors open during the construction?
Yeah, we're going to keep them open. Not only are we keeping them open during the construction, the other night, we kicked off Devil in a Woodpile's Thursday night out on the porch. It's summertime.
Yeah.
And while they were playing, the bulldozers were across the street still operating at 5:30. And so... we're just going to be the bitchy neighbor across the street that's going to, when they're saying, turn down that banjo, we're going to be responding, stop with the bulldozers. Or we have another option, which we told the construction workers last Thursday. Uh-huh. We're like, and by the way, dudes, PBRs are $3. So can we lower? So
we're
going to be crabbing at the construction going on across the street while our bands are playing. Or we're going to lure in those union workers with special discounts if they can actually show us they're a union member. Because, you know, when Lincoln Yards, when this all was getting pushed through last month, every union worker in the city that Lincoln Yards could find, because we know Sterling Bay probably uses a non-union subcontractors to do all their stuff, the most privatizing companies, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, they got some union guys to step up and say they needed union jobs on this Lincoln Yards project. So our little thought is that, okay, guys, if you're all really union, because we support the union, because we've always been a union bar, because we are in the center of steel worker union, the center of that. So we're saying, bring your union card. Show us that you're in the union, because we don't want any scabs in our bar, and we'll give you a free beer.
All right? Yeah, that's...
That way we get them off of the job site, and we get them into our bar, and we get new customers.
Jim Tutton is a tricky guy.
When the city gives us a $6 billion mega project, we make lemonade with vodka on special all summer long.
That's good to know that you'll be...
don't operate heavy equipment after you stop by the hideout.
Nick Dumpke and I do our first Tuesday show, first Tuesday of the month at the Hideout, and I guarantee you, when they see that we're doing this show, right, man, those machines will be three times the normal. It's like, the bar will be shaking. They'll be towing cars.
Right.
Chicago politics. Anyway, you alluded to the fact that yesterday's showdown, when we're taping this, is a Thursday. When you hear this, it'll be a Monday. Oh. Whoa, that's really, really trippy. But anyway, yesterday's city council showdown, Ed Burke was stood up, the old alderman, and Lori Lightfoot swatted him down like a pesky fly, right, as Fran Spielman wrote in the Chicago Sun-Times. Timmy, what did that do to you? What kind of thoughts did that trigger in your old Chicago brain?
So in my old Chicago brain, I immediately was like, oh, hell yes, okay? Knock him out! I mean, when she said, we'll take that under advisement, I just thought it was the greatest thing in the world. Then I opened up the paper and I see John Cass's column, and I think like, oh, I did it again, man. I immediately, as a Chicagoan, love to see the boss bust down, you know, some little guy. And when Lori did that, I was like, that's my boss. She's my boss, and she's sending down Burke. And then I had to that's my Chicago reaction, all right? Because we go hard. We play like that, right? And so then afterwards I thought, oh, damn, when Daly used to do that, or when, you know, Rahm kind of didn't do it, but because he was so snarky.
Yeah.
But so when I thought, I go, oh, here we go. Now we got Lady Boss. She's going to be the bully now, right?
And you're with the bully.
I'm with the bully. And so... Yes.
But wait, time out. In defense of Lori Lightfoot, are you a bully when the person that you're bullying is himself a bully? Is that a bully?
It's a hard one, because it's called the bully pulpit.
Yeah.
And she's...
And Ed Burke is a big boy. He should be able to handle it.
So it was great to see his get treated like that, right? Uh-huh. And he should have known better. But, I mean, I'm not even sure why. The fact that he did the gender, he was so concerned about he and she.
Yeah.
The fact he did that, I'm still trying to figure out, because he's a three-dimensional chess player, okay?
Yeah.
And there's something happening there, and I'm just not... You know, I'm the Chicagoan who loves to see the mayor be strong and do what she did, but at the same time, I know that Burke, there's always these guys, the pinstripe guy in the background with a triple three-dimensional game.
I'm going to say this to you, and this is going to counter what you just said. Years ago, the great Sid Ordauer, the legendary Sid Ordauer, I don't know if you've ever met him, he was... a political activist, and he ran the Jubilee Showcase, a big supporter of gospel music, and Impresario. He told me, he was an ally to Harold Washington, aide to Harold Washington, that the media is complicit in making Ed Burke and Ed Verdoliak smarter than they actually are. And he goes, Benny, they're not that smart.
Yeah.
You media build them up to be so smart, and they're not that smart. And I that's my kind of attitude. I mean, I hear what you're saying about Ed Burke. For the last 2 weeks, there's been this build up in the media, Tim, that the evil Ed Burke is plotting.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming. He's hatching. He's like this spider who's spinning a web. And look out, Lori.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he brought? They're talking about he versus she?
Yeah, because I was talking to a guy, a detective friend, all right? Not about Ed Burke, but about serial killers, okay?
Whoa.
A couple years ago. I know. I'm not connecting him with anything other than the fact they found 23 guns in his office when they went in. But anyway, here's the thing. We were talking about, he said, you know, the thing with these guys, they commit all these crimes over and over, and they get older and they get lazy. Okay? And he was talking about the Unabomber, and he was talking about all these different career criminals that for years and years and years, they get away with stuff. And then they get, at a certain point, they're just like, oh, shit, I could just steal that. I could shake down a Burger King. You know? What? Their Benny's on Irving Park needs an awning. Yeah, go get that. All right? Now, you know? And so they're so... He's 76 years old, Ed Burke. And so it's kind of like a basket. It's like any great pro athlete, right? There comes a point where you got to step aside and let the young guys do the stealing if you're an alderman. And it's like there's a whole new generation out there, and you got to just open up and say, guys, there's, you know what? I got my part. I mean, Ed Burke's got, I think he's got the house up. And by the way, everyone thinks, no, he is not underrated. Ed Burke is the greatest, okay? So if people are like, he's not as smart as he actually thinks, you know, as the
Wait,
media.
He's the greatest what?
He is the greatest, corruptest, number one. We got to live in a time where the Jordan of corruption was, I mean, he 50 years.
I'm going to say
no alderman has served longer.
Well, maybe not, but I would say, I would make this this before your time. See,
he beats Hinky Dink. He beats Bathhouse
Tom Keen. Tom Keen was the master. He wrote the book. Eddie Burks is just playing from the Tom Keen playbook. Tom Keen was the alderman of the 31st Ward.
Yep.
He was a committeeman, and he was the original Mayor Daley's floor leader and finance chair. Everything that Ed Burke did, Tom Keen invented.
Okay.
But the difference is Keen went to the federal penitentiary
for
corruption charge having to do with a land transaction. I forget the details.
It's always something stupid like that.
It's always something stupid.
Because they always, the FBI, they just look at it and they go, can we go back 50 years on Ed Burke? And they just said, nah, just tap his phone tomorrow. All right? So they tapped his phone tomorrow and the Burger King called up. And it was like his buddy who's in the news today or whatever. The guy calls up, yeah, boss, yeah, some Burger King over there on Pulaski is doing some work on the parking lot. Oh, really? Go give him a talk. All right? And he goes over there. What's going on, guys? Nothing. Right? And it he's going to, that's what they get him for extortion.
Well, that's,
but Burke is the best. He's the greatest. It's like been an honor to live in the time that he got to be, that I got to see this. I mean, since 1969, you know, the great, you know, year when man went on the moon, Ed Burke came in and set his foot, one small buck for man, one giant leap for this guy. And I mean, he surpassed his father. He got his wife on the Supreme Court. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, that's true.
Behind every great corrupt politician, there's a Bonnie behind there, Clyde. When does she get to like have a say in what's going on here? Who paid for those trips to Florida, honey? Why are we going to Europe every year? What about Honey Bear Farm in Wisconsin? That's one of the greatest deals ever made. And Ed Burke, he like pulled that off back in the 80s. He pulled that off when like Harold Washington was the mayor, and he figured out the Carson Perry Scott O'Hare Airport deal so that he could get Honey Bear Farm. Okay. He, you know, I mean, does anybody talk? He's still has that place, right?
I'm not aware of that.
But it's a resort up in Wisconsin that he got.
All right, now that was
alderman.
A great riff. There's a body behind that. Clyde is one of the greatest lines of all time from Tim Tutton. Now, let's shift gears a little bit away from the city council, away from city of Chicago.
Yeah.
Tim Tutton, as I said, for about 7 years, you were Arne Duncan's one of his press secretaries, press aides in Washington. Do I have the years correct?
Okay, after all that, you wouldn't know it, but I was the director of special projects, partnerships, and events
okay.
for the U.S. Department of Education. I work for Secretary Duncan.
All right, let me ask you this question. How in the world did you ever get that job? You, when you do the Hideout shows, if anybody's ever been to the Hideout, Tim is like a little to the left of me, which is, I don't know if that's possible, denouncing all the things that go on in this city. Very upfront about it, calling on people to sign petitions, challenge the powers that be. You got a job with one of the most mainstream bastions of civic Chicago, Arne Duncan. He's like doesn't get any more mainstream than that. How in the world, Tim Tutton, did that happen?
Because I'm a loudmouth, and guys like Arne Duncan are beautiful, intelligent, really solution oriented people, and they want, and he's a listener. He really does listen to people, and he wants to know what's going on, okay? And there's this thing that good leaders have, and they talk about eyes and ears, and they talk about, I need eyes out there, I need ears out there. We need to honestly figure out how to do things, right? And so I was, I could make this, can we turn this into a 7-episode podcast? Some, what, you know, like This American Life, or I could make it simple. I am who I have always been, all right? I was a loudmouth high school teacher, and I was always, like, getting my kids organized to do whatever. You got a march against handgun violence, we're going down to Daly Plaza. There's a rap contest about, you know, handgun violence. There's a clean energy thing, sustainable. My kids were in the history fair. We went downstate. I was an academic decathlon coach. I was the Model United Nations guy. I was always, we did a thing at my school with Studs Terkel, of all people, where we did the play Working, and we invited Studs Terkel. And Studs Terkel came to Jones High School, where I was at the
old
time.
Jones.
The old Jones High School.
When it was vocational school.
Jones Commercial. I was one of the teachers who was one of the teachers from when it went from Jones Commercial into what became Jones Academic Magnet, which became... Now, the new Jones, right?
Yeah, smart kid school.
And so I was, so anyway, we did this play and we invited Studs Terkel and we got a big story in the paper about it. And the bottom line is, my kids used to always come to school social studies and they used to say, how come every story about kids in Chicago is about gangs and killing and about how bad we are? Why don't they do positive stories about us? And so as a teacher, I turned that into my lesson, my whole, that was it. Everything we did, I said, if we're studying the Civil War, if we're going to write a paper about the causes of the Civil War, let's send it to the Tribune. If we're going to do a biography of somebody, Frederick Douglass, history, whatever, let's send it to the Sun Times. Let's send it out to the paper. Let's contact ABC News. So we kept doing positive stories. We're going to do the play Working. We'd like to invite Studs Terkel. Studs Terkel comes, come. So we got a lot of attention. Maybe that's because we were at Jones High School. We were downtown, okay? But it was also because our kids were involved. The Mikvah Challenge in the election in 1996 and 2000, all these things. So Arnie's communications guy, Peter Cunningham.
Oh, PC, Pete Cunningham, my good friend, PC.
I kept bumping into him.
Yeah, PC.
I kept bumping into him. And I kept telling him what he, I kept telling him how to do his job. I kept telling him,
I'm
why
sure
did
he
you?
Appreciated that.
He, to his credit, said, you know what? You know what? You talk a lot of crazy stuff, but some of your ideas aren't bad.
Wait, you started off with a Peter Cunningham imitation and you lost it. You start, you gotta like that. Tim, why don't you give me a call?
So that's
my PC imitation.
Because you're in the press, that's how you hear him. Okay.
How do you hear him?
I was a CPS employee, right?
Oh.
He was a CPS, and I was like saying, like, look, man, we work for the same operation.
Yeah.
And yet you don't see what's going on over here, over there. He was the kind of guy that was like, okay, show it to me. You know, why don't you? Okay, let's try that. Why don't you work in communications? You think you know how to do this? Why don't you come in? And he really said that. And I basically, for 2 years, said, there's no way I'm working downtown. Those guys, they're the problem. You're the problem. And he kept saying, if we're the problem, I'm telling you.
He called your bluff, man.
He called my bluff. And it basically was, I was constantly bitching to him about how they weren't really showing students and teachers and the union and talking about how hard it is to, you know, do what we do and the amazing things that our parents and kids are doing. And so he basically said, okay, all right, let's see. Let's do it. And so I was a teacher. I got assigned downtown. I started working in the communications office. I went on working as one of the managers of media relations for the high schools for CPS. And Arnie was the CEO. And every single thing, we would have meetings. What do you got? What's going on? What's happening down at Julian High School? What else is going on? You know, hey, let's do a story about Whitney Young winning the academic decathlon. And I said, let's do a story about Manly finally getting in the academic decathlon for the first time ever. There's the story. And so every time, let's do a story. You know, what do you got? And so Arnie and Peter, those guys were always like, okay, eyes, ears, pitch it, let's do it. And really, I understand from my critics that what I was doing was showing how great CPS was at a time when many people were critical of CPS. But what I would always tell the journalists, right?
Yeah.
Whoever it is, whether it's the Reader, the Sun Times, WBEZ, one of the things I would always say to them is, you know what? you are constantly hammering on CPS. You are constantly hammering on how bad the next story about the bad teacher, the next story about the bad school, the bad coach, the kid who hurt somebody, whatever, right? Uh-huh. And I said, and I just kept, my main theory was, what about Nutrier? What about Buffalo Grove? What about Lake Forest? Isn't that in your BEZ? Doesn't WGN cover? Don't you? Aren't you reaching out to Naperville? Why don't you cover DuPage County? You got a huge suburban. You're writing stories about CPS all the time to just feed into the Oak Parkers and all of those guys out there. I'm like, I think you need to look into River Woods. I think you need to check out Hubbard Woods. And so I constantly, what about the story in Grays Lake with that football team? What about the hazing up at Glenbrook North High School in Northbrook? How come the board up there? And so, okay, I know I'm going on and on about that.
No, but it's
I would
a great
say,
riff.
And whenever they would say, you know, this happened at this high school, that, I can remember we had some horrible things that happened from students. There were some kids that were students that had a, that were attendant. Okay, anytime a teenager is killed in this city, and it happens every week, okay, every time, it happens on a Friday, on a Saturday, it happens in a park. It's the most tragic thing in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Every time the reporter lists it, Julian High School student shot, Manly High School student shot. The first time that they finally identify that the kid attends a high school is when a tragedy happens. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know something, the kid, first of all, wasn't at Julian. No murders have happened at our schools. None of this stuff happens at our school. It happens on weekends when the kids that attend our schools that have counselors and teachers that are doing everything we can to help improve their lives, they go out on a Saturday night and something happens to a teenager, and the first thing the press will put down is Julian High School student killed, right? When we're the people that were trying everything to make Julian High School student live. So I would tell this to the press. You know, you are presenting our you are telling us teachers. You know what? If you really want a story, talk to the teacher whose heart is broken because their honor student just got killed. This Kadia Pendleton, when she died during President Obama's term in office, the kid who was in the inauguration parade.
Yeah, from King.
Okay, that story. You know why that hit? That hit our First Lady and President Obama and Arnie Duncan, that hit us so hard because it always was happening to us. And now there was the President and the First Lady and the Secretary of Education. And they were like, this shit's been going on for our entire lives. Mm-hmm. And now we were in Washington and that happened. And when that's just one example. That happened and the South Side, King High School, you know, we all just like stood back. When anyway, I know I'm like skipping over to Washington, coming back to Chicago. But so my thought was the interview should not be that whenever a kid would get shot, the reporters would call me up and they would say, can we talk to the principal? Can we talk to the teacher? Can we talk to some of the students at the school to see how they're feeling? And they would have students crying and things like that. And I said, you know, let's think this through. That student was taking Japanese. I think of that. They had a Japanese language class at Julian High School. Let's talk to that teacher about how they were working with that child, okay? Not about how, because the assumption is the kids are in gangs. The assumption is, why was the kid out in the park? Why did the kid get shot? Mm-hmm. It's always this quick. And who's listening to that? Who's reading John Cass's article? Who's reading the Tribune? Suburban readers are reading about the horrible situation in the city and how we're out of control and CPS and all of our schools are bad. Okay, so anyway, when I was working in media relations, I would constantly work with the schools. And we would go in and I would say, what do we got going on here? What's happening that's good? Okay, am I spinning anything? I'm not spinning anything.
Well, the difference is this. I hear what you're saying on your riff. And there's a lot of that you say I absolutely agree with. the notion that somehow or other, anytime there's a murder, it's linked to a public institution. It's a way of undercutting the institution, and it's a way of demeaning public schools. It's a way of demeaning the city of Chicago. It's a way of writing off entire neighborhoods, entire people. I completely agree with you on that point. My objection to, I wasn't even going here with the question originally, but I'm going to say it. My objection to the way publicity shops for the Board of Education and the mayor's office have operated in my lifetime in the city of Chicago is that essentially they're not in the business of disseminating public information so that we can be more aware of how our government is working, what its flaws are, what things we should know, what we could work on to improve, or what's working, and so we should continue it. They're all about putting the best possible spin on the individual who runs it. And the individuals change, Tim. I've lived through, good God, I can go Janice Jackson and Forrest Claible and Barbara Bird Bennett and Jean-Claude Brizard and Arne Duncan.
Going. No, before Brizard, after Arne.
Oh, there was the kid. Huberman. After Huberman, there was the guy from some foundation who was temporarily sitting in there because Mayor Daley, I'm going to give him credit. Against my Dave giving Mayor Daley credit. Mm-hmm. Unlike Rahm, was rushed through the TIF deal, Mayor Daley said, you know, I'm leaving office, so I am going to let the next mayor appoint the head of the schools. And he had that, the fellow, what's his name?
His name begins with an M. The guy who was
Terry.
Whatever.
Terry. And then before Terry, it was Ronnie Huberman. And before Huberman, it was your boy Duncan.
Yeah.
And then,
whoa. Slow down now. Stop.
What?
Okay? You just mentioned half a dozen, 10, who knows how many CEOs, right?
Yeah.
Arne Duncan was there for 8 years. Okay? So when you go in, and I even think he was there longer than Vallis.
Yeah,
so
Vallis was
there.
All
the crazy stuff that happened. Okay, so Arne was in for 8 years, the longest serving CEO in Chicago Public Schools.
Well, right? Wait, let me finish my point.
Okay.
So my point is, no matter who the head of the Board of Education is or the head of Chicago Public Schools, generally the mission is to make the mayor look as good as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that dumbs down the people of the city of Chicago. I think that makes, first of all, the underlying assumption of almost any mayor who comes in is that the schools he inherited were wretched shape. Mayor Rahm did that, which dissing the Mayor Daley before him.
Mm-hmm.
And now Lori Lightfoot hasn't played that game yet, but they always trash the school system that existed when they inherited so that a year later they can say, guess what, Tim? My God, we're so much better than we had been. And it's our great mayor. Let's now bow down to our exalted mayor. Mayor Daley was the education mayor. Mm-hmm. They called him the education mayor. Arne Duncan took his tenure at Chicago and used it to go to Washington and become the education secretary.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that would make Chicago the center of the universe as far as education. No, Rahm comes in, totally trashes the public school system, totally trashes the teachers, trashes the union, trashes and disrespects.
Take a chill pill, man.
Okay.
I've lived through all this stuff, man.
But when we go back to Arne, okay, Arne did everything he could to create stability, to create consistency. I know your callers, if you have any.
We
all
don't
right?
have callers.
Okay, look, man, here's the thing. Arne has a guy like me. Okay, and first of all, when he came on, I was like, he's Paul Vallis, he's Fallon Vallis. The hell with them. And that's the kind of thing I used to say. He's the guy now, he's gonna do it. And when I saw the way he was doing things, I thought, you know what? He's gonna take me out. He's other people. He was trying to create more stability. So he was not Mayor Daley's boy, Arne Duncan, okay? Arne Duncan comes in because Daley needed some freaking stability after the crazy Vallis. he was the guy, the reorganization, all the stuff, right? Okay? Right. I know Renaissance 2020. I'll just catch that before you
Okay. Didn't Pete Cunningham write the speech?
I
think Peter Cunningham wrote the speech.
But Arne,
the Renaissance 2010 speech.
But Arne, I have seen him. He reads his work. He does his homework. He sits in meetings. He listens to people. He argues. He debates. He gets different sides. And I'm telling you, man, you know what? I'm just going to say this, all right? when Obama got elected, and Arnie was an Obama guy, not a Daley guy. And Daley was an Obama guy. Daley was a Tom Hines guy. He was. Remember, he supported Hines in the 2004 election for Senate.
Time out. You're saying that Mayor Richard M. Daley supported Tom Hines, Hines. I don't think
Dan Hines in the primary.
I don't think Daley endorsed anybody in that
Brett
election.
Brett Hall.
Brett Hall's a hockey player. Blair Hall.
Blair Hall was acting like a hockey player in his personal relationships.
Okay.
He went down.
Wow.
Remember, Blair Hall was the front runner.
Yes, he was.
Okay. All right. Louis Gutierrez supported Blair Hall early on, right? Remember these guys?
Yeah.
Okay. Dan Hines, Barack Obama. Okay. Daley was not with Obama.
I just think Daley was quote unquote neutral in that race.
Oh, neutral. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Wink, wink, neutral.
Okay. So my point is that Arne Duncan was a guy who was seen as just more moderate and independent, not a Daley guy. Okay. But he's a quiet guy. Mm-hmm. Okay. He works with the mayor. He works at the mayor. He listens to other sides. So he was this guy who was just kind of a calm voice of reason. How are we going to do this? All right. And so he wasn't on this charter school binge. Like when Rom comes in, you get to see that's how bad it could be. What Arnie was doing was trying to say, if we're going to do a changeover for a school, if there's going to be a closure, there's going to be neighborhood hearings. Because that's the rules. He's a guy who played by the rules and was and
okay. Greatest charter school growth occurred. It started with Arne Duncan. Rom was sipping from that same charter school.
I think it started with Vallis, and I think Arnie had to make and there was a huge outpouring of people in the West and South sides and other places that wanted something done. They were so tired of their schools failing that there was this, and this we're talking about the 90s. We're talking about the late
90s. Actually, I disagree with that. Okay. I do not believe there was a huge outpouring of people on the South or West sides or anywhere for charter schools because I personally
believe.
They weren't
for charter schools.
I believe the charter school.
They were for changing the better schools.
Well, okay.
For their kids.
But charter schools were effectively become a tool. Now we're on a tangent within a tangent. But charter schools were effectively became a way in which the Republican political establishment used poor kids as an excuse to destroy teachers' unions. And I would have had, if the charter schools from the get-go had said, we will allow our teachers to be unionized, and we will insist that our teachers in our charter schools make the same amount of money and have the same benefits as the teachers in the quote-unquote public schools, I would have had no problem with the charter schools.
I agree with you 100%, and that's where I'm a member of the Chicago Teachers Union right now. I'm a teacher, and this is something I made clear. The fact that they weren't unionized schools, I can't even believe that ever existed. All right. And I will tell you though, that it's a little more nuanced than just the Republican thing. Okay. So Heather Staines, right? The Staines family helped start North Lawndale College Prep.
There were a lot of Democrats who drank from that Kool-Aid. And I would tell the Democratic Party, my Democratic Party, I've been loyally voting Democrat since the moment I was able to vote Tim Tutton. I watched my Democratic Party embrace these Republican ideological concepts about public schools.
I think you're over-exaggerating that. It isn't an embrace. It's we need to look at this. We need to try this. We looked at charters. Some people looked at charters as, all right, let's try this. It's a 5-year charter. Let's try it. People wanted schools. All right, let me be really clear. All right, I teach at the juvenile detention center now. Uh-huh. Okay, I believe in neighborhood, community, old school. I believe in neighborhood schools, not charters. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I hear you, but I'm telling you, 15, 16, 18 years ago, when this was starting to happen.
I feel as though you haven't come out of, you haven't emerged, evolved from it, from where the Democrats were back then. I'm telling you right now, when Democrats talk about the strategic play of the Republicans, they have to acknowledge that to a certain degree, they played along with it. And this is a notion that goes back to the days of Bill Clinton, and it's advocated by Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod, et cetera, that the way to win, and Clinton was the genius behind it all. They all learned from Clinton. The way to get ahead, the way to have a Democratic Party become the majority party is to convince people that we're not like the Democrats that used to be. And so they have to occasionally pick somebody that is represents as symbolic, it's epitomizes the Democratic Party, and then bam them. And that's their way of winning over swing voters. So what did Bill Clinton do? 1992. What were the first things he did? There was a guy on death row in Arizona. He got an airplane, flew to Arizona, and pushed the button so that guy got killed. And that was his way of saying, I'm not a wimpy Democrat. I will interrupt my presidential campaign to go pull the switch on a guy who's on death row. What did he do? He criticized Sister Soldier. It's way before your time. You don't even know what I'm talking about.
I know
Sister
exactly Soldier. What you're talking and that was about. His, I was 32 years
okay.
old.
And that's
the hideout
way.
Was started in 1996.
All right. That's...
The year, in October and in November, we had a party to. We hated Clinton. We had a one
but
of our worst things.
That,
no, no, I never.
That's
I know.
The same thing with the charter schools. So what are they going to do with charter schools? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to prove to swing voters. They got this notion of swing voters that we are going to stand up to teachers unions. And so they made teachers unions the enemy. They bashed teachers union. They said the secret to educating poor kids is that you have to have good teachers and. Unions coddle bad teachers. We get rid of the unions. We lower their power. We're going to get rid of bad teachers. And you watch, those kids at the Cook County Jail are going to be scoring as well in their achievement scores as kids at New Trier. That was the rhetoric that the Democratic Party put out there. And that is Republican rhetoric, man. And I've been fighting it for 10 years.
Okay. I don't know why. I just get too loud. I'm not arguing with you. Everything you said is correct. Okay? Everything you said is correct. All right. And I never was a guy who drank that Kool-Aid. I was always a guy who was like, no, I'm good. I don't need that. Right. Okay. But you're right. There was some degree of watered down Kool-Aid being drunk. Yes, you are correct. I can't believe I'm even in this discussion about these because because Arnie and other people know I'm not a charter. I agree with you. Okay. That said, when I went to Washington, okay, and the reason I was part of that team was because they wanted people, all right? I'm a union guy, okay? I'm the guy, all right, that when we were doing meetings in Washington, D.C., listen, the Secretary of Education, we had a goal. We were going to go to two schools every day. We had a goal when we got to D.C. in 2009. We're going to go to all 50 states. And we did. We're the only one. Maybe Vilsack, the agriculture sack. I think maybe him. He heard about this, and he's like, "Oh, damn! I got to do that too." All right. We went to every state. We followed up on all these invitations. Schools would contact us and say, "Could the secretary come to our school?" I'd put that in my thing, and I go, "Can we go to Burlington, Vermont? There's some kids with an organic garden in their playground. Can we go to Montana? There's a Native American reservation in the Northern Cheyenne group that they want to do a trust circle. Can we do that?" And I mean, the people in D.C. who were used to working for Margaret Spellings, okay, who only went to big cities, to conferences, to speak at universities, they could not believe that we are like, we're going to go to Vermont, we're going to go to West Virginia, we're going to talk to kindergarten teachers there. Okay, so my point was, when I got to D.C., they were so used to 8 years of Bush, okay? They would say, okay, you're going to have teachers in the group? Well, you should have the principal, you should have the superintendent, you should have, you know, the A-valedic, whatever. They would, like, that's what a grouping of teachers was. And my first thing was like, where's the union delegate? Okay, where is the teacher, the science fair? Where's the student council president? And so literally then we changed that. I mean, the career service people were just like, who are you bringing in? The union delegate? Are you sure the secretary's okay with that? You know, yeah. Rhode Island teachers are freaking out up there about this, right? And so, and I can tell you, Arnie was always like, hell yes. We do it. We must have the delegate there. We need, you know, when they asked him, you know, are you okay with this line, the guest list here? He'd be like, yeah, of course. Right. You got the angry parent, all that. Right. So what I'm saying is that he believed in an inclusive table where people would feel this is real, okay? And my job was to make sure those voices were heard, all right? Occupy was happening. Bring in Occupy, okay? It was like Journey for Justice, G2 Brown, okay, from Chicago. He couldn't get heard that from Mayor Emanuel. So you know what he did? He turned the march and went to Washington. Yeah. And guess who heard him? Arnie. We G2 came in to the Department of Education. He's just one of many, the badass teachers out of the bats out of New York City, okay? They would come and they would say, can we have a meeting?
No, I have to give Duncan credit for this. I really have to say this. When you mentioned G2 Brown, a flashback, that had to do with the Diet High School protests. And they could not get a meeting with Mayor Rahm. And they, I remember this when the mayor's emails were revealed, when the Sun-Times FOIA'd the emails.
Yeah.
It turned out that the strikers went to Pete Cunningham, the aforementioned Pete Cunningham, who always teased him. He was like the bridge to liberals for like the dailies and the Rahms. He was like their guy to go talk to people like me. But they went to him. Tim, I just found this so revealing about how Chicago was working in the years of Mayor Rahm. It was Randy Weingarten, who was the head of the teachers union, AFT, one of the most important and influential union leaders in the country, had to get Peter Cunningham to be a liaison to get Rahm Emanuel to answer her phone call. You know, if Mark Zuckerberg was calling, Rahm would pick up the phone like that. And that just spoke volumes of where the city was. So I give, at that time under Rahm, I give Cunningham credit that he kept the bridges open. I always give him credit for
that. That's right. He did that. And all those reporters in Chicago, okay, the local news people in Chicago would call Pete, they'd call me. And they go, Tim, do you got a contact at Huberman's office? Do you have a contact in Rahm's office? You know?
That just shows you how low the bar is, by the way.
They would call the U.S. Department of Education Assistant Secretary for Communications so that they could get a hold of somebody down at CPS. Yeah. Right? I'm sorry. That's... okay, so that was then. Okay, that was under Rahm. All right? And so my point is, and they would often, and this is so Chicago, okay? So Chicago. Yeah. You know, Chicago guys call up at Alderman, whatever, and they just go, yeah, Tim, can I talk to Arnie? And I'd be like, well, you need to schedule an appointment. He goes, all I want to do is a call. You know? And I'm like, you need to schedule a call with Arnie. And they'd be like, what do you mean? Can you just give me his number or put me through? You know, and I'd say, he's got a full schedule. You need to call, like what? Like tomorrow? Like when? I just need to ask him a thing, right? Yeah. Chicagoans are like, but that was also a testament to him and the kind of open door that he had. People would pull him over and go, we had to teach the Secret Service detail in Washington, D.C. These guys would come up to him like after meetings and after town halls and stuff. And the security detail, I had to teach him, you need to stand 10 feet away from the secretary, okay? And people would come up, yo, Arnie, what's going on? I mean, I remember Bill Ayers, all right, in San Francisco. Bill Ayers.
Bill Ayers.
Yeah. Whose wife, Bernadine Dorn, will be at the Hideout on Monday night, tonight, for
tonight,
the Monkey
right.
Bench.
Anyway, wait, what's she going to be doing at the Hideout?
We have we have comedy every Monday night, and so tonight, the Monkey Wrench will have a number of stand-up comedians. They always do political humor, and then Bernadine Dorn will
She's
be the special
stand-up?
Guest. She is going to be interviewed by Arish Singh, who's a comedian, but he started a couple months ago interviewing interesting people and getting their take on their life, on their comedy, on their sense of humor.
I never thought of Bernie Dorn as being stand-up, but hey, I got a few jokes.
She's not doing stand-up. No, she's doing an interview with a stand-up comedian, he's just going to talk to her about stuff.
A rabbi, a priest, and a minister walked in a bar.
I remember going to an event out in San Francisco. It was a packed room. It was like the Education Journalist Association. And by the way, a lot of these journalists that are still working today, you know, they would call me up. But anyway, he just walked
Bill
up.
Ayers.
Bill Ayers.
Yeah.
Arnie, let me talk to you. And I'd be like, come on, Billy, man, not now, man. We're in San Francisco. What the hell? You know? Yeah. He was like, shut up, Tim. You know? Like that. And he's like, hey, Arnie, what's going on? Arnie's like, hey, what's going on, man? All right. What's going on? Wow, you're out here in San Francisco. Huh? That's great. Okay, great. You know? He never palled around with Bill Ayers. Let me just make that
clear. Okay, just get that clear.
Okay, that used to be an issue back in the election.
Oh, 2008. John McCain. I remember that.
An issue.
Yep.
Yeah.
Bill Ayers commercials, like he's a friend of Bill
he's
Ayers.
He's a University of Illinois professor who's an expert on education.
You're talking about Bill Ayers, yeah.
Bill Ayers. And of course, the secretary, Arnie, he obviously
knew him. They're Hyde Park people, too.
And that, too.
Yeah.
So, but it's like the old Chicago thing. We're like this big city, but we're like, hey, come on. Everybody knows everybody. What are we doing here? What, you got to go? I got to schedule through your guy?
Yeah.
What's going on?
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Right. Which is a classic because. The other day when Kellyanne Conway walked up to Nancy Pelosi said, yeah, do you want to say something? You know, do you got a comment on Trump? She's like, I don't talk to staff. I talk to the president. I had a flashback to when I was in D.C. One of our jobs was that you do not let staff doesn't talk to the principal. That's what you don't go up to the senator, the governor, the president, whatever. You protect them, right? Which made my job interesting because in the earlier, under Margaret Spellings, a guy like me was supposed to block people from talking to her, okay?
Uh-huh.
My job was to make sure that people were able, because Arnie literally be like, what are they thinking about out here? What was that teacher? Wasn't there somebody here that wanted to say something? Like during like an event, a town hall, there'd be a teacher that'd be like, God dang it, I gotta talk to him about this, right? And I would say to that, if they come up to me, how do I get to talk to him? I wanted to ask a question. I didn't have a chance. They ran out of time. Literally, I'd be like, if you could just stand by the doorway, we'll be walking right out that route, right? And then as Arnie would come, I'd go, there's a teacher who wants to talk to you about charters. There's another union delegate. She has an issue. There's a parent who has a special needs child. And he literally would just be like, okay. And then my job would be the opposite of blocking him. My job would be connecting him so that he was able to meet different people. And you know what we did that? We did that in all 50 states. We did it in Haiti. I even went down there with them. We did it 405. I can't believe I'm spending all my time talking
That's
about
all right,
this.
Man.
But
let's go.
When you see the TV show Veep, okay, people would always say, is Washington, D.C. like House of Cards?
Yeah.
Like, is it like that? I'm like, actually, it's like Veep. And I was one of those Veep guys, a staffer. But my job was to make sure that the secretary was connecting directly with teachers, parents, and kids, and making sure that the security detail understood that we're accessible.
All right, now
and we did that.
Okay, so you've had experience in Washington, you've had experience here in Chicago, and you're also as a kid you were really into politics. So you grew up reading about politics.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you the question I asked Mick Dumke earlier when he was in the show, and we'll close down the interview with this question: based on your observations, based on what you've seen by reading the newspaper, what you've seen firsthand, what you've read in the history books, who, in your humble opinion, is the most deranged president of your lifetime? Is it Donald Trump? Is it Richard Nixon? Is it Lyndon Johnson? Is it Ronald Reagan?
Yeah.
Bill Clinton? Who, in your opinion, I may have forgotten, George Bush, Barack Obama, who is the most deranged president of your life?
So I'm born in 1960. My first president that I was conscious of was Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, some people might be Kennedy folks. I'm an LBJ all the way, okay? I can't watch those movies about LBJ, even the bad one with Woody Harrelson, okay? But the new one with Bryan Cranston. I started crying the minute he came on, and I never stopped crying, okay? To me, LBJ was, again, if you get any people calling in or whatever, I can't even think of my life without LBJ. LBJ, he was a Southern guy. My dad was a Southern guy. LBJ was the guy that everybody thought was just LBJ drinking whiskey. Look at the dog with the ears. Oh, mom. You know, and all that. I look at Lady Bird Johnson.
Yeah.
I will cry. Lady Bird Johnson is the living. She was the epitome of my aunts down in South Carolina. She was strong and smart, and she was hardworking, and she was thoughtful. She was the one that started sustainable environmentalism, right? Mm-hmm. She was the one with the, they're like, oh, she did the wildflowers. No, she talked about xeriscaping, okay? She was amazing and an advisor to the president. LBJ, he was the guy on the outside. God dang it, we're going to kick some ass. And on the inside, he was the guy that sat down with Martin Luther King on the same couch and said, all right, man, what the hell are we going to do here?
Oh, there's only a problem.
You're going to march. And Martin Luther King hammered at LBJ. And LBJ was like, I know what you're doing. I got to do it. So LBJ, Heartbreaking. So we follow that with Nixon, okay? And I was 8 years old, a Cub Scout, and I was, and not only that, Nixon got me to run for student council, okay? I became my student council vice president, president. I never lost an election all the way through high school, all right? And by the way, when I was in high school, I finally, my junior year, instead of running for student council president, I ran my friend's cat and called it Richard Milhouse Cat, okay? Because we were living, and this the time, that was 1976 when we did that, right? So I looked at Richard Nixon as like the worst. I grew up in junior high, high school, the formative years with Nixon, right? And I looked at that. But I got to tell you, Nixon, I don't know if it's the Neil Young song that even Richard Nixon's got soul. I don't know what it is. I looked at him like, dude, you are a pathetic, sad person. But I always felt, and this is terrible, I always felt really bad growing up that he was so just angry and so bad. And I remember, though, I'm telling you, you know, and I think of Bernadine Dorn, you know, I had two things, my two most important books were my Boy Scout handbook, which taught me how to camp and how to make fires, and Steal This Book by Abbie Hoffman, which taught me how to make fires and make bombs, okay? And I remember thinking, like, what a real American is a Democrat and a progressive and fights for justice and equality. I'm serious. That comes out of LBJ, the Great Society.
Yeah.
That comes out of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. When I was a kid, I remember our teachers telling us, you know what? The Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And then I went to work in Washington, D.C. The building's called the Lyndon Johnson Building, okay? The oak that is the symbol of the Department of Education was the live oak that LBJ read books under when he was a kid. We did an event where we planted a tree from the Hill Country of Texas, and we brought Linda Burr Johnson down to do it. My point is, Nixon, who's the worst? Donald Trump is a sociopath. He is not narcissistic. He's a sociopath. He is a mean-spirited, and it is sad, of the tragic upbringing that he had as a child that made him what he is. He has no clue what he's doing. He just says shit all the time, and he says mean things. He hurts women. He hurts people around him. He doesn't trust anybody. He has no, if it's Michael Cohen, if it's Manafort, people, he has no friends, right? So I feel terrible for this guy, Donald Trump, but he's sociopathic. He does not have any empathy at all for any man, woman, or child. Treats his children horribly, and he was treated horribly. And being a teacher who works in the county jail, I'm obviously very conscious of a child's upbringing and the effect that it can have on their life. But that's Donald Trump. Nixon was this this person that what he did with Cambodia, it is beyond the Watergate. Mm-hmm. Screw that. All right. He broke in. That's a horrible thing, right? He was bombing Cambodia. Yeah. Okay. He was going into Laos. He was lying about the people. He said he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War. While LBJ, my president, was president, he was secretly talking to those, the Viet Cong or whatever, about how, don't end this war now.
Yeah, he was.
Okay?
What he was doing was sending messages to the North Vietnamese to say that he's sending messages, to the South Vietnamese saying, stall, that you'll get a better deal when I am the president. Just stall. So he was undercutting the Paris peace talks and dragging out the war. But I cannot, I must at this point.
Okay,
oh my God,
wait,
I'd say that war escalated under LBJ. So let's just put that out there, that the Vietnam War, the main years of escalation was from roughly 1965 to 1969.
It did. And you know what I believe? I believe it did. And I believe LBJ was, it wasn't just because he knew he would lose. Okay. I think LBJ in his heart was absolutely, he got to that place. Here was civil rights in the Great Society, and I'm a believer that he just was devastated by, I can't end this war. This is the most worst thing. And he felt, you know, but my point about Nixon is, okay, Trump is sociopathic, okay? I believe that, certifiably. Mm-hmm. I think Nixon, he has something, the really dark, dark side of America, okay? He is this misunderstood, intelligently brilliant person, okay, who was smart and had people around him that were loyal to him. I remember when I was a kid, I had the Watergate playing cards. Everybody else was saying, okay, let's do the lineup, yeah. The Cubs. We got Ernie Banks, we got Billy Williams, we got Ron Santo, Randy Huntley. You know, they knew all of the players, Leo DeRocher, right? I was the kid going, Haldeman, Colson, Ehrlichman, John Dean, you know? I, like, knew the names. And then I'm like, Sam Irvin's on the Watergate committee, and, you know? And so I'd be like, listen, Sam Nunn, and naming all these people.
Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean. It all fits a pattern, if you dig what I mean.
But I looked at that like Nixon was a horrible guy, but I looked that he was with a circle, a cabal of evil men, but they were friends or something. And I did feel that he had some kind of belief that what he was doing was the best for an America that had gone out of its mind during Woodstock and the 60s and all that. And he thought, in his way, he was making America right again. And so that's fascist and delusional and horrible. I mean, you know.
But it's not as bad as Donald Trump. That's your point.
No, what he did was he was truly a fascist. Donald Trump is this horrible buffoon. Not buffoon. He has a sickness. He has a sociopathology. Well, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I've been struggling with this. I was telling this in the earlier interview with McDonough. I've been saying this all week. I've been doing some reading of the history and reacquainting myself with life in America that I grew up with, and I'm now realizing that it's an obvious point. There's some patterns that are reoccurring in our country that we fight so hard against. And for all the criticism I make of what Barack Obama and Arne Duncan did in regards to hurting teachers' unions with their embrace of the charter school, I would never in a million years even remotely compare them to what Donald Trump is doing right now in terms of these overall patterns.
Look at Barbara Bird Bennett. Look at Forrest Claypool. Look at all that. Did that, Arnie?
All right, we'll end the interview there, the conversation here. We'll be going for a long time. That's Tim Tutton. We could talk forever, as you can tell. He is one of the co-founders of The Hideout. I urge absolutely everybody to check out The Hideout's webpage, see what shows, concerts, plays, political meetings are coming up. I must say, if you got looking for something to do tomorrow, because this airs Monday, McDumpkin and I will be at The Hideout at 6:30 for First Tuesday, and you get to hear Tim live on stage with whatever he's pitching before we come on. Thank you very much, Tim Tutton, for being with us. Thank you, Dr. D. See you tomorrow, everybody.